I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, cheap summer vacation may sound like an oxymoron, but we will offer some thoughts about enjoying time off without going broke. It's the first of our series for Cheapskate Week. But first, medicine and race. Well into the 1960s, many state and local medical associations openly discriminated against black physicians. The American Medical Association, the country's largest and for many the voice of the nation's health professionals, either ignored or abetted this discrimination. The AMA recently concluded a study about the history of medicine's racial divide, and that study, which is being published on the AMA website this week, culminated in an official apology towards the African-American medical community. Joining us to talk about this are Dr. Carl Bell. He's a professor of public health and psychiatry at the University of Illinois at Chicago Medical School, and Dr. Ronald Davis, the immediate past president of the AMA. Gentlemen, thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Good to be with you.
Dr. Davis, if we could start with you. I understand the apology is the culmination of the study started in 2005 about the history of the racial divide. Can you tell us a little bit about the study?
Sure. We set up an independent research team to look at the history of the AMA and our treatment of African-American physicians. We opened up our archive of documents to that team, which goes back to 1847, the year that the AMA was born. And after several years, the group came out with their preliminary findings late last year. And after we took a look at the findings of the committee, the AMA leadership was profoundly apologetic for what had been discovered. We knew that there had been problems in the past, and after all of the detail was collected, we felt horrible about what had been uncovered, even more so than the anecdotal stories that we had heard previously, and we felt that we wanted to issue a very public, very official apology on behalf of the entire organization to African-American physicians and the organizations that represent them.
What does an apology accomplish in your view and in the view of the AMA leadership?
Well, obviously, the people who are around today in the AMA leadership were not present many, many decades ago when these problems existed. These problems occurred around the time of the Civil War all the way through the 1960s. But we felt that what a group apology like this does is it indicates the current moral orientation of the organization, and it lays down a marker that we can use to judge our current and future activities. This apology is really all about looking at our past so that we could build a better future, working with people like Dr. Bell and leaders of the National Medical Association.
Dr. Bell, what's your reaction to the apology?
It's somewhat late. I experienced it, so I don't know that there was a study needed. I would like for the AMA to recognize that these things are still going on. If you look at health disparities in African-American people, that's, I think, directly related to the historical racism that was perpetrated against African-American physicians. And I understand the need to try to distance themselves from the past and say that wasn't us, we're this new group of people. But that stuff is still going on.
Could we talk about your experiences, Dr. Bell, for a minute? You'd indicated, you said, you know, like I lived it. Tell us, if
well,
you would, a little
you know,
bit about what you experienced.
Graduated from the University of Illinois with a B-plus average in 2 years with a major in biology, two minors, one in math, one in chemistry. You would think they would have been able to let me into medical school. But back then in 67, I had to wind up going to Meharry, a black medical school, which, by the way, was one of the better things because they taught me public health, and I suspect had I gone to the University of Illinois, I would be practicing money instead of medicine in 2008. I have heard multiple stories from various impaired physicians, you know, physicians who get caught up in drugs or problems with mental illness, and they go to the AMA's impaired physician program. And as usual in this country, when blacks commit crime, they get harsher punishments than whites. That continues to occur. And just watching the poor health care that African Americans receive, the AMA's constant trade association refusal to endorse national health insurance so that we could join the rest of the civilized world, things like that are offensive to me.
What are some of the patient impacts, Dr. Bell, of this history of discrimination? What do you think the impact on health has been?
Well, clearly the impact on health has been earlier death, 6 to 7 years in African Americans, higher rates of infant mortality, cancer, lung disease, heart disease, diabetes, a lack of, I mean, when we worked on Dr. Satcher's culture, race, and mental health report.
The former Surgeon General.
The former Surgeon General, 16th Surgeon General. What became extremely clear was that there has been very little, very, very little research on African-American health problems. And all of that has fallen to the National Medical Association and Black physicians. And we just did not and have not had the infrastructure or the resources to do a very good job of that. And yet we're on this planet together. We all share the same health ecology. So I remember when Satcher was trying to go to Zaire to study the Ebola virus, Congress said, what's that got to do with us? And he had to tell them germs don't need a passport. The AMA has done some good things. They did develop a prison health care system that spun off to the National Commission on Correctional Health Care. But then they've just been benignly neglectful of African-American health issues.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm speaking with Dr. Carl Bell, an immediate past president of the AMA, Dr. Ronald Davis, about the AMA's apology for its past treatment of African-American physicians. And I would have to say African-American communities as well. Dr. Davis, the AMA is following the path of a number of institutions, particularly the states, that have expressed regret for their past roles in discrimination or slavery, for example. But some people argue that this is too little too late and that it actually lets the community off the hook for present and future conduct. What do you say about that?
Well, we look at it in a positive way, and certainly we wish that we would have been in a better position to issue an apology earlier on, but we felt that it was better to collect all the data and have this independent writing team produce a very scholarly report on exactly what happened through the years. And let me just respond to some of the specifics that Dr. Bell raised, and we agree with them wholeheartedly that the AMA and all other healthcare stakeholders need to pay much more attention to the problems of the African-American doctor and the problems of the African-American patient and consumer. And so, for example, in recent years, about 5 years ago, in fact, the AMA worked with the National Medical Association, which represents African-American doctors, and the National Hispanic Medical Association, which, of course, represents Hispanic physicians, to form a very important national coalition called the Commission to End Healthcare Disparities. We've been working hard to raise awareness that healthcare disparities by race and ethnicity do exist and that we need to develop and implement strategies to reduce and ideally eliminate them. And that commission has been hard at work in doing exactly that. This year we've given out $120,000 of scholarships to minority medical students to help deal with rising tuition and financial indebtedness. Now, that's not going to solve the problem, but it's our part, which we hope other people will join. We also have an important program that was started by the AMA's Minority Affairs Consortium called Doctors Back to School, where we send physicians, typically minority physicians, to minority communities to talk to students in elementary school, middle school, high school, about how they too can aspire to become a doctor so that they can help take care of people in their own community so we can get more minorities into the physician pipeline. Only about 2.2% of practicing physicians and medical students are African Americans in this country.
And that figure has been constant for what, like 100 years?
A long time.
Why is that, Dr. Davis? Why do you think that is?
It's way below the 13% of the general population that are African American. And we're doing a little bit better in some aspects of the AMA, where 5% of our committee members and our section leaders are African-American. But all of us need to do more so that, and here's the two goals for the future that I have to underscore, so that we have at least as much diversity in the physician population as we do in the general population, and so that we have zero tolerance for discrimination against any patient based on race, ethnicity, gender, sexual orientation, or any other characteristic.
Dr. Bell, this raises a final thought that I wanted to get from you, which is because of ongoing patterns of migration around the world, this country is increasingly diverse. There isn't just a black-white dynamic anymore. Right. And I know you see this in your work in Chicago. Is there a need for a discussion of racial dynamics in medicine apart from the historical black-white paradigm?
Well, you know, for me, the solution to the problem and the multiculturalism that you're talking about is to focus on public health, which the AMA, predominantly a trade organization, has not been focused on. They've been focused on business instead of doing what the Hippocratic Oath suggests, which is to be moral and ethical and responsible for the public's health. They do some of that, but that is not their driving force.
You know, Michelle,
Dr.
I'm a
Davis,
public
final
doctor,
thought.
Mm-hmm. And I want to thank Dr. Bell for bringing up the issue of public health. I'm trained at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and here I am just finishing my AMA presidency as a public health physician, and I've been raising this point for a long time within the AMA and outside the AMA, and I couldn't agree with Dr. Bell more that this has to be at the top of our agenda. I'm pleased to let people know, many of whom don't know, that one of our five priority areas at the AMA in our advocacy agenda is public health, focusing on healthy lifestyles, tobacco, alcohol, diet, physical activity, focusing on disaster preparedness, and also focusing on eliminating health disparities that we've just...
How about national health insurance?
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, too, because I'm also pleased to say that the number one issue in our healthcare advocacy agenda is covering the uninsured. We have a national campaign going on right now, three-year multi-million-dollar campaign called Voice for the Uninsured, where we say that we have 1 in 7 Americans who lack health insurance, but every one of us has a voice. And so when we decide who to elect for the next president of the United States, let's take this issue into account when we vote for that person.
Dr. Davis, I gave you the first word, so I'm going to give Dr. Bell the last word. Dr. Bell, final thought?
Well, I mean, I'm glad we got the apology. I hope it's not all spin.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Dr. Carl Bell is a professor of public health and psychiatry at the University of Illinois at Chicago Medical School. He joined us from WBEZ Studios. Dr. Ronald Davis is the immediate past president of the American Medical Association. He joined us by phone from his home in Michigan. Gentlemen, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Just ahead, one man's journey to a new life in America. National Book Award winner Ka Jin's bittersweet account of his first summer in America. But first, we're kicking off Cheapskate Week, where we'll try to offer practical ways to save some cash in these uncertain times. Today, it's the family vacation. Gas and food prices are stubbornly high, the stock market's in the dumps. For many, that makes the usual summer vacation more of a luxury. But there are ways to make it affordable. Maybe you could be a tourist in your own hometown. There's even a term for it, staycations. Here to tell us more is Nancy Lewis. She is a family and consumer science educator at the University of Maryland. Welcome. Thanks for stopping in.
Thank you, Michelle. It's a pleasure being here. Thank you for inviting me.
Where did this term come from? Do you know?
One source I read about said that staycation might have come from a Canadian TV series.
No, that's interesting. I wonder. Well, we're happy about that. You recently taught a class about staycations. How did you get the idea for this class?
I had seen a news show and heard about staycations, and I was planning summer presentations at the Frederick County Extension Office, and I thought that this would be a fun thing to bring.
Well, get us started. How do you plan one? How do you get us started?
Well, you first have to get out of the mindset that a vacation is something that you have to, where you have to travel outside of your area, travel out of state or wherever. And once you get situated there, you use the whole family, you include the whole family in planning this activity. And if you stay at home, you use your home as a home base, you can go out and take day trips someplace, and each member has an input into what is going to happen during that time off. You also want to treat it like a vacation, and that means getting prepared ahead of time, doing your bills and the heavy chores, so that even if you are home, you're not vacuuming and you're not paying bills or anything.
You know, I was going to ask you about that, because one of the reasons I like to go away is that if I stay home, I'm looking at all the dust bunnies under my dresser and I'm getting irritated.
Right.
You know, I'm out there, I'm like cleaning up all the things that I don't do.
Right.
Kind of when I'm at work and I'm annoyed. So I think you're saying the first thing to do is you act like you're on vacation.
Right. Do all those things ahead of time. Also, prepare a budget. Figure out how much you want to spend. And try to stick to that budget, you know, if things are flexible. also let people know that you're going away on a staycation. Even though you're going to be in the local area, tell them not to call. Nobody from work bother you. And to put your cell phones and computers away. Unless you build in some downtime during the vacation, everybody should have something, some downtime to relax and do what he or she wants to do.
Do you recommend creating an itinerary? I know a lot of times when you travel, you create an itinerary for yourself because you want to be sure you're really taking advantage of all the attractions that your destination has to offer. Do you recommend doing the same even if you're staying at home?
Yes, it is important to create an agenda. Because stick to it, because you are on vacation and you have to remember that, you know, because it's so easy to get distracted.
You were mentioning to me earlier when we were speaking a little earlier that you recently moved to this area,
mm-hmm.
and you've been exploring lots of activities and attractions here, and you find out that people who've been here a long time have never been to and have never seen. I bet you there are lots of things that are kind of hiding in plain sight. How do you avoid overlooking the obvious in a place that you've lived a long time?
Well, you can start out and get information at your local visitors bureau in the area. I visited the Parks and Recreation. I read the newspapers. They always have an itinerary and a calendar of events. I've contacted the Maryland Tourism Bureau. I've checked out websites for the area. I enjoy Civil War history and American history, so this area is rich in that. And I also love Washington, D.C., so that would be included in my staycation, is taking day trips and using mass transportation to get into the city, which cuts down on the fuel that we use. So,
and Washington, D.C. is a great place for mm-hmm. a staycation if you live in the area, because there's obviously a lot of things you can go to, like the Smithsonian Museums, for
right.
example, where they don't charge an admissions
mm-hmm.
fee. But what if you live in a city that's normally kind of pricey, where some of the things that you might want to do, you might say to yourself, okay, if I'm going to visit X city, I'll pay that $20 to go see such and such, because who knows when I will be here again.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? How do you account for it if you live in a city that's already expensive?
Well, I think that is put into your budget. And if you really want to do something like that, you might spend that money towards that special activity and then just cut down on the other activities you do. Some people even stay at home if they have a pool in their yard. They have they do activities in the yard, or they can get together with neighbors to have different activities, fashion shows, movie nights, things like that, and to do that kind of thing.
What do you think about the idea of checking into a hotel in your own city? What do you think about that?
A lot of hotels in your local area are offering special packages because they want to keep the dollars in the local area. And so you can go into a motel for a night, you know, swim in the pool, and that would be like you're going away. I heard about one woman who took her family camping in the next town. The kids didn't mind. They had a great time camping, but they just went one town over. So there are so many opportunities in your local area to explore, and a lot of them are free. Your local libraries offer activities. The Cooperative Extension offers like 4-H camps for the kids, and sometimes maybe you want to send the kids to camp for the week, and you and your significant other go off and do something fun in the area.
So what I hear you say is really the key to it is attitude. If you're going to mm-hmm. Be on vacation.
Exactly.
No matter where you go or stay. The final question, Nancy, how do you address those postcards?
Well, most people are going to know that you are still in the area, but you address the postcards and say, hi, having fun. Maybe you take a picture of your house or have a picture of your whole family on the postcard. And you forget to add the part where it says, wish you were here.
Okay. Nancy Lewis is a family and consumer science educator at the University of Maryland Cooperative Extension Program. She was kind enough to drop by our Washington studio. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Michelle.
Just about every week at this time, we dig into the pages of the Washington Post Sunday magazine for interesting stories about the way we live now. This week, the magazine featured its summer reading issue. It includes four essays by well-known writers about an important event or time in their lives. With us now is one of those writers, National Book Award winner Ha Jin, author of Waiting and Free Life. Ha Jin joins us now. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
I don't know whether your life seems that way to you, but to me, your story is so interesting. You joined the Army at the age of 14. You started teaching yourself English while working on a railroad. You were among the first to go to college after the Cultural Revolution. You came to the U.S. to work on your advanced English studies. You managed to bring your wife here. Of all these experiences, how did you choose the moment in time that you chose to write about for the magazine?
You know, my editor, David Rowe, told me that it should be a piece about a summer. So for me, that is really one of the most important summers, a summer of a transition that would change my life. That's why I just could not forget a lot of things that happened during that summer. That's why I decided on that summer.
I'm going to
the summer of 85.
The summer of 85, when you came
yes.
to this country. The first sentence of the essay reads, "In college, English meant humiliation to me."
Sure, yeah, because I was among the first group of young people accepted by colleges after the Cultural Revolution. That means for more than a decade, there had been no students accepted through the entrance exams. That also means in the society, all kinds of talents had been accumulating. And so there were all kinds of people who were very knowledgeable. And for instance, in my grade, there was a student who wouldn't go to English classes. He just stayed in bed reading Charles Dickens. And whereas like people like myself, we just knew a few words of the language.
You didn't realize how far behind you were until you got there.
I had no clue at all. And in fact, in the whole year, there were five classes. So people were divided into five levels. And for me, the humiliation was that for 5 years, I stayed at the lowest level.
How did you manage to get into an American doctoral program, starting so far behind and having to sweat so hard just to manage the basics?
In the early 80s, suddenly American literature became very popular. The students, we were very fascinated by the new literature, which was really unheard of before. And because the subject matter was not always political, and there were all kinds of new techniques we didn't know before. I got somehow caught up with this trend at the time, so I decided to study American literature.
So you just loved it so much that it kind of kept
yeah.
you at it. It kept you
yeah.
at it. I must tell you that just about every sentence in this essay has something marvelous to think about, like what you had to go through to actually get your tickets, which involves a bribe of cigarettes. But we'll skip past that. The core of the piece is what you had to go through to bring your wife. Because you weren't allowed to bring her with you. Why weren't you allowed to bring her with you, by the way, to begin with, and your son?
At the time, almost all Chinese students were going to foreign countries were not allowed to take their spouses and children with them because that was a way to prevent them from staying. And in fact, also the authorities would not give permission to take in your family with you.
So you were planning to be separated for 4 years. Did you
yeah.
realize how hard that was going to be when you got on the plane after paying your bribe of expensive cigarettes?
I didn't. I think most of the Chinese students going abroad assumed that that was part of life. You have to take it.
How did you realize you didn't have to take it, that perhaps you could, you know, buck the system, as it were?
And once I was here, I had began to have friends, we talk, and I saw students from other countries. They have their children and their spouses. So gradually I realized that, in fact, everybody has had the right to be with them. So I began to try hard to find out the procedures for achieving that.
Just wondered how you were treated as a as a Chinese student when you came to the U.S., I just wondered, did you ever feel any sense of distance from the other students?
Yeah.
Just wondered if you had some thoughts there.
There was a moment when I really talked to one of the officers at the university and trying to figure out how to bring my wife over. And basically, I was stonewalled. And that was the only unpleasant moment I remember. But it really, it was a shock at the time. On the whole, I think I had a good time. As you know, Brandeis was a very liberal-minded, liberal and open place. But on the other hand, because I had grown up in China and had no sense of freedom, didn't know how to use freedom and or basic human rights, I really had these things were alien to me. So I felt psychologically kind of isolation from others, not because of them, but because of my own past. But gradually I got out of that, gradually.
Was there anything good about that time, looking back on it?
Of course. I think the good great libraries was fabulous, and also one could buy books for like a quarter at yard sale. And that really, I began to collect books, and I wanted to bring back a personal library with me. I was very naive at the time. So there were a lot of good experiences. Also, I began to have friends from other countries. Also, I began to learn how to drive. That was a amazing experience.
In Boston, no less.
I know. Sometimes I got into the wrong way. You know, that's the hard part, really, to know the roads. It's a lot of the driving.
And I should mention that when you came here, you never expected to stay. You always saw it as sort of a brief sojourn, especially because you couldn't bring your wife with you. Why did you decide to stay?
That was at the time when I was finishing my degree in 1989. Suddenly the Tiananmen tragedy happened. That really threw me off my plan. And I was really in a shock after that for many weeks. And then my son came out by himself. And I realized I wanted him to become American. And so that also meant I would have to stay some years in this country. And then gradually I realized I should immigrate and to make a new life here.
The piece is so rich with wonderful details, as of course one would expect. But I wanted to ask, what do you think you'd like people to get from your piece?
I think I want people to have some kind of a glimpse into the new arrivals' beginning, I think. Because there are a lot of wonderful things. There are also a lot of, I think, traps. For instance, money was a big attraction. A lot of people got lost in making money. I could have easily. And so I think providing some details and unify them, I hope the readers can see that the arrival was not always wonderful, but still it is amazing.
Ha Jin is the author of Waiting and Free Life. He's also a creative writing professor at Boston University, and he was kind enough to join us from WGBH in Boston. If you want to read his piece in its entirety, you can find a link on our website, as well as a link to the other pieces, which are all quite remarkable, at npr.org/tellmemore. Professor Jin, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle. Oh,
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Getting through college can be tough for many students, considering the academic pressure, the high cost. But what about when a student is in the U.S. illegally? We've all heard of undocumented workers. Now, because of a group of students at UCLA, we are learning more about undocumented students. Some of their stories are collected in the book Underground Undergrads, UCLA Undocumented Immigrant Students Speak Out. We're exploring this issue as one of our Behind Closed Doors conversations. Joining us now are Kent Huang, editor of the book and director of the UCLA Center for Labor Research and Education, and Mariana Zamboni. She is a formerly undocumented student. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thanks for having us.
Kent, if I could start with you, what gave you the idea for the book?
I've been teaching at UCLA for the past 20 years, and over the last few years, I've had a remarkable group of students in my classes. I teach labor studies and ethnic studies at UCLA. And these students are some of the most gifted and talented students of my career. The problem, however, is that they are undocumented. So as a consequence, they can't get a driver's license. They can't apply for financial aid. They can't get student loans. And upon graduating, they can't even legally work. So through my work with these students, we at the UCLA Labor Center decided to teach the very first class that would focus on the issues of undocumented students in the broader context of immigration and higher education.
There are some states in which you can get a driver's license without documentation of citizenship, but I think it's surprising for some people to learn, given all the paperwork involved in going to college, all of the, you know what I mean? I mean, there's the proverbial thick envelope and all that that represents in terms of the paperwork, that you can go to college without being documented. I assume that varies from state to state, but how is that possible?
Well, within the state of California, because of the passage of Assembly Bill 540, undocumented students now are able to attend higher education without paying out-of-state tuition. And so that has been a huge boom to many undocumented students who want to pursue higher education.
Mariana, would you just tell us a little bit about your experience? And when did you come to this country?
I came to this country when I was 7 years old.
Can you just tell us a little bit about how and why you came to this country? And what was the decision like to think about going to college, knowing that you were undocumented?
I came to Los Angeles to be reunited with my mother. She had left Guatemala in 1988 because the economic instability that Guatemala suffered due to the civil war that lasted 36 years left Guatemala in very bad conditions. So my mother, you know, moved to Los Angeles to work and to make some money, and her plan was to go back. All her family's there. Her children were there. But Guatemala did not get better, and it was easier just to bring me along. So I moved to Los Angeles when I was a second grader. So throughout school, teachers, administrators had a lot of vision for me. They had high expectations. You know, I was a good student. They told me, work hard and you can go to college. So that's what I did. When I was in high school, I discovered the impact that my undocumented status was going to have in completing a college education. And I was pretty torn down. I was actually pretty depressed that it was going to be extremely hard.
What was the main issue? What was the main obstacle? Was it the fact that you'd have to pay out-of-state tuition, or were there other things as well?
The main issue was, yeah, getting the money. How am I going to pay for school if I can't qualify for financial aid and if most scholarships are not even open for me? My family is working class. I'm going to be probably working in underground economy, which is, you know, $5 an hour. So I knew that education was important. So in my mindset, I said, even if it takes me 8-10 years to complete an education, I'm going to do it.
How did you do it?
Oh, with a lot of support from so many people. At the same time, I think the law that Kent talked about opened the doors of education for me. It allowed me to start community college and eventually transfer to my dream school, which was UCLA. But it was definitely with the financial support of many people. My grandmother's Social Security pension, friends letting me borrow money, many times kind of starving myself or eating oatmeal and macaroni and cheese so that I won't spend money for food. It was, I lost 20 pounds, I think. You know, my first year at UCLA was because I was sacrificing so much sleep and so much food, you know.
What was the hardest part and what was the best part?
The hardest part was wondering if going to school was the right thing, because I knew that being undocumented, it was going to be really hard to get a good job afterwards. And good job, I mean, to utilize my degree. Friends that were graduating were going into construction, and they were waiters or waitresses. So I felt, is this pain that I'm going through of finding pennies to pay for school, was this even worth it? I think that was the hardest. The best thing, I would say, is that I think I walked out of UCLA with more than just a degree. I learned tenacity. I learned that if you keep on knocking on doors, something will be open. To be grateful. And these are lessons that no matter if you have all the money in the world, you must learn these through struggle, through pain. So I think that's the best thing that happened to me.
Ken, I was wondering how you were able to figure out who was undocumented and who wasn't for purposes of putting this book together. And was there any risk involved in some of these students coming forward? I know you're using pseudonyms in some of the throughout the book for some of the people that you write about, was there any risk to them coming forward?
There is always a risk among these undocumented students, and I am so amazed at their courage to step forward and to emerge from the shadows and share their stories. Many of them talk about the greater risk is to be quiet. The greater risk is to not share their stories and to not let people know what is going on. About 65,000 undocumented students graduate from high school every year. And, you know, we as a society have invested tremendous resources in these young people. You know, they are required under law to attend public school. And many are graduating and want to pursue higher education, want to be able to contribute to our society. But until there is a change in the law, they are really limited. And so when we put together this publication, we were very conscious of the fact that, number one, this is a story that had to be told. We had to let people know what is going on. And at the same time, we had to respect their concerns about their own personal risk. And so when we put the book together, we were very conscious of using pseudonyms when appropriate, not using photos of the students or taking photos in the shadows. The cover of the book is, you know, one of the students featured in the book, but he's in a shadow, so you can't recognize the features.
What are some of the other stories in the book that you can tell us about as briefly as you can, Kent?
One extraordinary student, Tam Tran, who is a Vietnamese student, but she's never lived in Vietnam. Her parents were boat people. Her father was a prisoner in Vietnam, and they fled the country, and yet they were picked up by a German boat, while most of the Vietnamese boat people were picked up by American boats. So she was born in Germany, and she came to this country when she was a very young girl. She's lived in this country almost her entire life. She doesn't know German. She doesn't have any memories of Germany. And yet, although she just graduated from UCLA, and although she'll be starting a PhD program at Brown University this fall, she's stateless. She is not Vietnamese citizen because she's never lived in Vietnam. She's not a German citizen because Germany does not recognize citizenship based on birthright. And although she's lived in this country and has gone to school and has done everything that our society has asked her to do, we are not willing to give her legal status. And so she's in limbo. Here's a brilliant young woman. She's starting a PhD program in the fall. And unless there is a change in the law, she will not be able to legally work upon graduating.
What's she going to do?
That's a big question. Many of these students who we work with and we talk to, we ask them this question: well, if you can't legally work, why are you committed to go to college? And they respond to us and they say that they are hopeful, number one, that there will be a change in the law and that they will be able to practice their chosen professions and their chosen careers. And number two, that an education is something that no one can take from them. It's something that they will have throughout the rest of their life.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're speaking with Kent Hoang and Mariana Zamboni about the experiences of undocumented undergraduates at UCLA. Kent is the editor of, and Mariana contributed to, a new book about their experiences. Kent, the book is very sympathetic, as you might expect. It tells the stories of these students very vividly. There are stories of these difficult and sometimes dangerous crossings to get to the U.S., the tenacity of the students, as you discussed, you know, their hard work, their dedication. There are some who will say that's all fine, but they're still breaking the law. And this is a nation of laws, and the laws have to be respected. What do you say to that?
Well, I'd say, number one, that we are a nation of immigrants. and that immigrants throughout the generations have contributed immensely to this country and contribute much more than what they take. And these particular young people had no say in the decision of coming to this country. They were brought to this country as children by their parents or by relatives, and that it is in our society's best interest to provide these young people who consider themselves Americans, who speak English, who have lived most of their lives in our country, it is in our collective interest to provide them the rights and the status so that they can practice and contribute to our society. Even many members of the business community support the Federal Dream Act, which has been introduced a number of times in Congress and was unfortunately blocked when it was introduced last year, would provide legal status for undocumented students who could prove that they have strong moral character and that they have completed either 2 years of college or service in the U.S. military. So it is an opportunity for undocumented students to earn legal status in this country. Many in the business community recognize that we have a tremendous need within our society for trained, educated people. And it is a very short-sighted position for us not to grant status and to provide the opportunities for these young people to contribute fully to our society.
As you know, higher education in this country is very expensive, and the top-tier schools very competitive to gain admission to. This is an issue that surfaced in the whole debate around affirmative action. There are those who say that, well, if you're admitting students with lesser qualifications, it's unfair to the students whose qualifications are perhaps superior, and that needs to be part of the conversation too. I'd like to ask if you consider that question around the whole issue of the undocumented students. I'm sure there are some who would say that there are undocumented students there, however worthy they are as students, however dedicated. They're taking the space of American students who are fully qualified by dint of their citizenship. What would you say to that?
What is remarkable is how well many of these undocumented students have done in spite of the barriers and limitations that they face. So we are not asking for any special privileges for these students. We are asking that they be allowed to compete just like any other student to gain entry to the university and to qualify for financial aid just like any other student.
Mariana, did any of your fellow students know of your status, or was that another layer of the college experience, feeling like you had to hide a part of your identity?
Very few people knew in my community college. When I transferred to UCLA, I learned about IDEAS, which is a student group on campus that's composed of undocumented students or those that are in support of our education. So that was our community. We would help each other. We would lend each other books. We would do fundraisers, selling sweet bread, or even later on we started doing banquets, fundraisers.
Was it scary being part of a group like that, though? Did you ever fear, like, I'm bringing unwarranted attention to myself and this could be a problem?
Honestly, and when IDEAS first started, it was very underground. We didn't advertise our meetings or the location of our meetings anywhere because we were definitely scared when the whole anti-immigrant sentiment was growing. But later on, when we discovered that there's legislation that would help ameliorate our struggles, we decided to be vocal about them. And that being vocal about it has empowered us in many, many ways. Sharing our story heals many of our pain. And so many of us are activists now and talking about the issue.
What I'd like to ask you the same question I asked Kent Wong, though, which is there are those who would say, I think it's great that you're such a dedicated student, but the law is the law. And if you're here without appropriate documentation, then the consequences have to follow from that, that there are other people who came here the so-called right way and that they need to be given access to the opportunity of being in the U.S. first if they came here the right way, and that people who came without appropriate documentation have to suffer some consequence or need to go home until the situation's sorted out. What do you say to that?
Mm-hmm. It's a really hard question, I'll be honest with you. I think there are many, many factors that bring immigrants to this country that are, not really talked about. But I think what I want people to know is that we do want to obey the law. You know, I don't think, like Kent said, I did not know what was going to happen with me. Like, I just knew I was going to go meet my mom, and I just obeyed, you know. And this is a very particular case. It's of students that have grown up here, that want to contribute, that have degrees. And we just want to give our best to the American society. If people say, just go back to your country, we feel foreigners. We feel like a tourist. We feel American.
Kent Wong, if I could have a final thought from you, what would you want people to get from this book? What do you think this book will add to the ongoing debate about immigration that we are having in this country?
I think that the role of undocumented youth and students in our society is something that has not been covered adequately. And I do think that the power of this book is that it puts a human face on a huge group of students and youth who are Americans. They grew up in our communities. They attended our public schools. They are doing everything they can to be a part of the American society and to fulfill the American dream. And I think that most people, when they hear their stories and when they put a human face to this issue, will respond very sympathetically and will understand that, yes, in fact, there should be a change in the law to provide an opportunity for these young people to fully contribute to our society, and that that would be in everybody's best interest.
Kent Wong is editor of the book Underground Undergrads, UCLA Undocumented Immigrant Students Speak Out. We also heard from Mariana Zamboni. She contributed to the book, a recent graduate of UCLA. She just completed her master's degree in education from Harvard University. They both spoke to us from our studios at NPR West. Thank you both so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
If you want to hear Mariana Zamboni reading her poem Invisible that she wrote about the plight of undocumented students, we will have it on our webpage at npr.org/tellmemore.